Good morning. It's 20 years since decommissioning, or since the whole decommissioning issue became one of the main topics in the news. See, the Irish News have handed over 6 pages of their paper today to that story, decommissioning, the inside story. Let me speak to Alison Morris, who's been writing most of it. Alison, good morning.
Good morning.
Spotlight on decommissioning and the serious weaponry on the front of your paper is just a reminder, first of all, of what sort of arsenal existed with various groups here in Northern Ireland.
It did, and I think it was just one of the many sort of news features and events that we've been looking at as we approach the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. And at the minute, we're in a pretty sort of pessimistic and dire place politically, but it's nice sometimes, or I think it's good and healthy, to reflect back on just how far we have came. And that decommissioning process was quite extraordinary, because at the time it hadn't taken place in any conflict situation anywhere else in the world. It was unique to Northern Ireland, and we know why that was the case. We know that unionists in particular were very uncomfortable, and their electorates were uncomfortable with the possibility of going into power sharing with Sinn Féin. Decommissioning became, and you remember, you and I are old enough to remember reporting from that time, it became a major issue, and to try and get over that hurdle seemed almost impossible. And then what followed, obviously, is the smaller organisations. The two loyalist groups, the NLA and the Official IRA, then also decommissioned in the years that followed. And while it wasn't a perfect solution, and there was certainly guns that escaped that process, it did take thousands of guns out of circulation in Northern Ireland, and that's what we're reflecting on in the Irish news today.
Yeah, just looking at it, I haven't been able to read every single word of it, but the spotlight seems to be on the Official IRA. Is that because the provisionals wouldn't talk about it?
Well, it's not because they wouldn't talk. What happened at that time is the Provisional IRA's process, as we know, was done mainly in secret, but with the observers in Father Alec Green and Harold Good, who were asked at that time to come and observe the process to give the public some perspective on what was happening, and also to try and reassure those who didn't think that it actually was happening. They thought it was all a big con. So I interviewed Harold Good at his home at the end of last week, and he discussed, you know, what had happened in the run up to that, and what him and Father Alec Reid did together, and how that process then sped it around the world. The reason why we've concentrated just on the Official IRA is that organisation had taken pictures of the decommissioning process, and through a freelance journalist who I work with on the story, had agreed that they would allow us to have those pictures and the inside story of their decommissioning. But we also, as I said, I spoke to Harold Good, who was the observer. Father Alec Reid, as we know, is now dead. And so Harold Good remains as the sort of last man standing from that time, and his story is fascinating. And what he also then tells us, which is documented in the paper, is after that he was then asked to go to the Basque Country. At that time he was told him and Alec Reid were being given an award, and when they got there they realised that was basically just a bit of a cover, and they were there to discuss the decommissioning of Etta's weapons. And that happened last year, and Harold Good was there to observe that. And he also then got involved in the Colombian peace process and the handing over of FARC weapons. So you can see why we're only a little small place in the world. That event was huge, you know, and it did have a repercussion and a knock-on effect, and it is being used in other places around the world. And also this week, wasn't it strange that Cyril Ramaphosa is now the new president of South Africa, and he was actually involved in our decommissioning process, and has said since then that he is sorry that South Africa didn't decommission, because the place became awash with weapons after the end of apartheid there.
Father Alex and Harold Good would have witnessed the disposal of an arsenal. You know, I don't know how many guns or weapons are in an arsenal, but it would have been massive. When you look at what the Official IRA had, that's in your paper today, the weaponry that they're disposing of publicly with the freelance photographer, you could multiply that by I don't know what number it would be for the Provisional IRA. But how would Father Alex have known, or Harold Good have known, what percentage of the weapons were being decommissioned? I talk to people all the time who believe that significant caches of weapons still exist.
Father Alec Reid and Harold Good were there as observers to the process. The actual mechanics of it was done by General John de Tastelin and the decommissioning body. What they said at the time is that they had used inventories that came from various intelligence organisations about what weapons had been brought into the country and what they believed they have. But we know that not all the weapons were decommissioned. We know that there was decommissioning and that it was done in good faith at the time. And Harold Good says today that he was there because there were no cameras, that him and Father Alec were there as the eyes and the ears and the cameras and the lenses for the people who didn't get to see it, and that he believed that those he was involved with were genuine. But what we also know since, and history has shown us, is that the South Armagh and the Michael McKevitt faction of the IRA were not on board with that, and they did withhold significant amount of weapons. There were some of those weapons found not long ago, I think it was about 2 years ago, during in the South, that were believed to be ex-IRA weapons. And we know from some of the bombs that have been used by dissident Republicans have contained some Semtex in them, and Semtex isn't made anymore. So therefore, we know that that Semtex had to have came from provisional IRA caches. So some of it was withheld either by people who weren't in favour of the peace process, or some of it, even in the case of the official IRA, were sent. Some of it, the people who were in charge of minding and concealing those weapons had died, and they couldn't find them. They just didn't know where they are. And therefore, they're somewhere. But at the same time, too, it was hugely symbolic, and also, in a practical term, thousands of weapons were removed. We know that some were retained or held back or missed that process, and therefore it wasn't a perfect process by any means. But it most certainly was a huge event in all our lives. It was hugely symbolic, and as I said, the fact that it was rolled out and that other countries then replicated that sort of Irish model, I think, was hugely significant. And I suppose it's nice to look at something that happened that worked and it was positive and that did help bring about peace when we're in a position now where I think that we're all feeling a bit despondent about the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement and what has been really achieved.
Do you think the Provost refused to appear in a photograph masked as these official IRA men are, but they refused to appear in a photograph because it would have looked like some form of surrender?
They didn't want their decommissioning photographed at all, and they didn't want a photograph because if you go back to those times, no sensitive negotiations, some of their membership weren't particularly on board for what was happening. They thought things were moving too fast. And it was constantly said to the provisional IRA at that time, this has never happened anywhere else. Why are you giving up your weapons when no other conflict situation around the world ended the same way? And then we had, and we reflected that today as well, then you had Paisley, who, remember, at the stage was on the outside of the process, who was saying, this has to be done in a sackcloth and ashes way. You know, we want them humiliated, we want them surrendered. So all those sensitivities all played into it. So therefore, instead of having any photographs or any photographic evidence, the deal was that it would be observed by these two men, you know, these two men who I think that we all came to know and respect in later years. And strangely, when I was going through the historic archives to do this, I was looking at the official IRA's feud with the INLA and then later the provisional IRA, and I noticed a throwaway line in an old news report that said eventually the end of that bloody feud, which claimed 11 lives, was negotiated after a local priest, Father Alec Reid, stepped in and negotiated. So there was, you know, if you went right back to the 70s, Father Alec Reid was in there in the middle of that, trying to negotiate peace, you know, between two rival factions. Then fast forward, and there he is again, you know, in the decommissioning process, again trying to help this peace process. And Harold Good said a lovely thing to me. He said when he was asked to do it, he realised what a mammoth task it was, and it would take him away from home, it would take him away from his family and all his other commitments. And even told when he said to his wife, Clodagh, you know, I couldn't do this without your approval. Like, think about this. This is going to take me away, you know, probably months on end. And she said, you have to do this because there'll be a completeness in it for you. You know, you will see something and have seen it through to the end. And he said he thanked her for giving him the permission to do it. And there was a completeness in it. And while we can look back and pick it apart now, it still was such a massive thing that happened at that time. I don't think anyone believed it was ever going to be possible.
Yeah, there are two men who played a vital role when you do look back at it. It doesn't seem like 20 years. It seems like 30 or 40 years to me, the Good Friday Agreement. I don't know how you view it, Alison, but it seems like longer to me. This is only the 20th anniversary of it. So much has happened in those 20 years. And, you know, when you look back and think of the horrors of the past, you think of Alex Reid kneeling over the corporals in Andersonstown. You think of Alex Reid, as you say, sorting out differences between the IRA when they had their feud and people were being killed on the streets. And you think of him being involved with Harold Good in the decommissioning. All of what has happened down through the years, and now we're in the stalemate that we're in at this present moment in time. People constantly say it's the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, and I think, is it not the 30th anniversary? No, it's not. It's the 20th anniversary. And we are where we are now, but we seem to be in free fall again.
It's strange, isn't it? Because like yourself, sometimes I think that was a lifetime ago, and then other times I think, oh no, you know, my space and time are running to one sometimes. I have difficulty distinguishing between what length of time has passed between anything. I think that what is interesting is as we approach this, we look at all the heavy lifting that was done back then. It was done by people like David Trimble, like John Hume, like Martin McGuinness, you know, and Paisley, even to a degree, when you listen to what Harold Good says, you know, he doubted there was decommission, and then he came on board with the process, and then we had him in government with Martin McGuinness. And when you think about that, and then you look at now and the political crisis that we're in now, when you think about stuff like the Irish Language Act and same-sex marriage and things that should be easily overcome, when we overcame those massive issues, those huge issues that no one thought could ever be resolved or ever fixed. And that's why I think now when people are saying the Good Friday Agreement's dead, I'm like, look, let's please not throw this away completely. Let's think about all the good and the positive that came from that process. What we have had is we had a peace process, but we don't have a political process. And I think that naively people thought 20 years on we would just be a normal functioning democracy. And what has happened is we haven't sort of nurtured that peace, if you like. You know, we haven't nurtured the political process. And that's quite clear, you know, that at this stage now, we shouldn't be where we are. We should have a functioning executive. We should have a functioning government, and we should be arguing with each other for sure. But we should be arguing about very simple things, you know, about health and education and things that other governments and parliaments around the world argue about. We still shouldn't be in this war footing, if you like. You know, people are still in that sort of defensive mode, and you'd imagine after all this length of time we would have managed to move away from that. And unfortunately the case is that we haven't had a proper political process. We did have a peace process, but not a political process.
Sinn Féin reminding us as recently as today that there won't be direct rule, and the DUP saying there will be direct rule. Sinn Féin emphasising that as a result of St Andrews there can't be direct rule. If there is direct rule, what's the next move for Sinn Féin? What do they do? How can they stop it?
Karen Bradley's gonna update Parliament today, and we'll know better after that. I would assume what she's going to do is we will have what we've had for the past 13 months. We will have this direct rule light, as I call it. You know, she will have to implement a budget. She will have to do all those things and make sure that we, you know, the lights stay on. But at the same time, too, I don't think she's going to install direct rule ministers for numerous reasons. Also, first of all, it would be admitting that this is done and that these talks processes are done. And we have heard from Theresa May and Leo Varadkar saying they don't think this process is finished, that there is still wriggle room there. And also, there was a point made earlier that the Conservative Party don't have spare MPs to be sent to Northern Ireland. They're in a pretty dark situation themselves in Westminster, and all their votes are very tight and almost down to one or two hands. So they have to keep their MPs where they need them rather than send them here. There will have to be, I mean, people deny that there's joint authority. We do have a form of joint authority here already when it comes to cross-border things, you know, cross-border issues. With Brexit, we know both governments are heavily involved in that. With health, you know, if you lived in Donegal or Derry, you'd be using hospitals on either side of the border on various occasions, and the same thing happens with Newry and Dundalk. So we already do have joint authority as such, and we have joint cross-border cooperation. Direct rule, I think, is a complete direct rule is a nuclear option, and I don't think anyone's ready to push that button yet. And also, it will not be an ideal situation for any of us, because it will be quite a harsh Conservative direct rule. But also, it will be tough for Nationalists, because you have a Conservative Party who are in a deal with the DUP, and the perception will always be that they're favouring that section of the community. So it's something that I think people are keen to hold off for as long as possible. I assume after this afternoon, when we hear Karen Bradley speak, that we'll know better exactly where we're placed.
OK, well, listen out for the Secretary of State later on. We'll have that on the news, of course. If you want to read about decommissioning, the inside story, as written by Alison Morris, it's all over the Irish News today. Alison, thanks for joining us. Thank you.
No problem. Bye.
This is the Frank Mitchell phone-in. Good morning.